This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The Durham Police Department remains in the spotlight for issues of racial bias. The city's Human Relations Commission recently affirmed allegations. Those conclusions followed a six-month investigation. During that time, they considered data collected from various sources used both by activist groups and by the police department. Last week, Durham Police Chief Jose Lopez was on this program. He defended the department and denied racial bias.
The fact of the matter is that we're not targeting individuals because of their race. We're targeting individuals because of their actions.
Well, today we have another perspective. Ian Mance is a civil rights attorney for the nonprofit advocacy group, the Southern Coalition for Justice. Ian, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Also with us, Frank Baumgartner, a political science professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He published a statewide study of traffic stops and searches, and his research is much quoted. Frank, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
You conducted a statewide analysis of traffic stops, Frank, traffic stops and searches in 2012. It was commissioned by a group called the North Carolina Advocates for Justice. Tell us where you got your data and what you found.
Okay, I'd be happy to. It's good to start with this background. In 1999, the state legislature passed a law requiring all police departments over a certain size to collect information about the basic demographics, age, gender, race, ethnicity of anyone that they pulled over in a traffic stop. So that data has been collected by pretty much every police department in the state of North Carolina since January 1st, 2000, or some smaller departments since 2002. But nobody ever analyzed the data. So I was able to get the data from the North Carolina Department of Justice. So it's the official data that are reported by each police department on a monthly basis. And we analyzed over 13 million police stops of passenger cars. Statewide, what it showed is that the likelihood of having your car searched after you're stopped for a traffic violation, speeding, or whatever it might be, the overall likelihood of being searched is 3%. But for blacks and Hispanics, it's higher than for white drivers. And the statewide disparity was 77% for black African-American drivers. They were that much more likely to have their car searched compared to whites. So that was the nature of that original report, and then we've done some more work focused on Durham.
You did. And tell us about Durham, and how does Durham compare to cities like Raleigh or Greensboro?
Well, it's very interesting and a little bit troubling. I know that Chief Lopez was here saying essentially that there's no issues in Durham, and I wish that that were true. And I want to be clear that, you know, nothing in this report suggests that the officers have a personal animus or any kind of prejudice, but the numbers do speak for themselves. First of all, the statewide average search rate is 3%, but in Durham it's 9%. So drivers are three times more likely to be searched in Durham, which compared to other cities in the state. Winston-Salem, the search rate is 3%. For black males, it's 5% in Winston-Salem. In Greensboro, it's a 6% overall search rate, but for black males, it's 11%. But in Durham, it's 8% or 9% overall and 15% for black males.
Well, let me stop you there and ask Ian from the Southern Coalition for Justice. I know that you worked with Frank to control factors that might skew the data. Look, here's what the chief said. He said, I understand what those numbers say, but we have good reasons to make those stops. We have good reasons to make those searches, and it has to do with law enforcement. We're doing our job. We're not racial profiling. And that the numbers can't prove, while they clearly show disparities, they don't prove profiling or racial bias.
I guess what I would say to that is that we may not be able to speak with absolute precision about the percentage of which of stops which are illegitimate. But what we do know is that in Durham, for example, the black male population, 17.5%. Probably even less of the driving population when you look at DMV car registration data. And yet black males, for some reason, make up fully two-thirds of all drivers who are searched in the city on an annual basis. So that's a very large gap. We also know when you look at consent searches, which constitute two-thirds of the searches, vehicle searches that the Durham police engage in on an annual basis, that African-American drivers are overwhelmingly more likely to be asked for consent to search, but no more likely to be found carrying contraband in their vehicle. They're over 100% more likely to be asked for consent to search, and over the last 10 years, only about 2% more likely to be found with contraband of any kind.
Now, this consent is important because what it means is the officer didn't have probable cause. They didn't pull you over for probable cause, but they wanted to pull you over and then ask if it was okay with you. I don't have any particular reason, but I would like to search you and your car.
Correct. Probable cause searches, the statute that Frank was referring to actually requires that the police record the reason that they conducted the search. And then they can, as the chief said last week, record multiple bases for search. I think the chief grossly overestimated the number of searches that are recorded as consent searches and probable cause searches. I just went back and reviewed the numbers last night. And over the last 5 years, only about 30% of vehicle searches were either probable cause or what we call Terry searches. Terry searches being where an officer might have reason to believe that a suspect might be armed. This is a relatively small percentage of all the vehicle searches. The overwhelming majority of the searches that we are talking about in Durham are in situations where police do not have probable cause to believe that a crime is committed and don't have any reason to think that a suspect is armed. We know that overall, about 60% of all the searches done are these consent searches. And if you look at other jurisdictions throughout the United States, you'll see that that number is typically much lower. A lot of police departments set a 40% benchmark for consent searches as a percentage of their overall search population. And for a long time in Durham, that's about where we were. Since 2007, however, we've seen a marked increase in the rate of consent searches. Almost all of those additional consent searches have been black drivers who have been no more likely to be found with contraband. And that 60% threshold has held firm now for about 6 or 7 years.
Well, let's talk about that, because, again, if you're going to search somebody, you assume that there's some reason, something has compelled you to take the extra step and the extra time to go through a search. One of the more disturbing findings, I think, is how little is found in those contraband, how little contraband is actually produced.
Right. One of the reasons that the department has proffered for why they conduct these searches is they hope to interdict weapons. But when you look at the actual seizure rates of weapons, you find that vehicle searches are an extremely inefficient way to find weaponry. In the first 4 months of the year last year, which was the last data set we had available to review, the department conducted 606 searches and only found weapons on 9 occasions, not all of which were guns. So you have a weapons hit rate of less than 1.5%. That's a small fraction of what it was a decade ago if you go back and look at what Durham police were finding back then. If you talk to defense attorneys around town who represent violent crime suspects, most of them will tell you that it's very rare that their clients even own a car. And so to the extent these increased searches are aimed at interdicting weapons, it's just proven to be a very inefficient strategy. The vast majority of what they're finding are small quantities of marijuana or prescription drugs. And I think 80% of all contraband seized fall into that category.
And it's a small percentage of the overall hit rate, as you say. So, Frank Baumgartner, you're a political scientist. You do this for a living. It's a profession. You're familiar with the phrase, correlation is not causation. What do you make of these numbers? Do they add up to some kind of profiling? And what is it that you said earlier, look, it's not about police officers with animus. On the other hand, you feel like something is happening here that should be investigated?
Well, there's a number of causes that could lead to these disparate outcomes. But let me first say that while we can't prove causation, as everybody knows, we did our best to control for various things that might be related to these different outcomes. For example, was the driver a man or a woman? How old was the driver? What time of day was it? Was it 2 o'clock in the morning or was it 2 o'clock in the afternoon? And was the driver pulled over for speeding, a traffic run stoplight, for a vehicle equipment violation, or what was the cause of the stop? And when we control for all those variables, we still find 165% disparity, even controlling for all of those different variables. And that's all we can control for with the data that the state mandates that be collected. So I do think there is something there. I would also say that while it doesn't prove anything by itself, it certainly is reason why a police department executive or any leader of a bureaucracy like that or an agency should want to look into it. And what we saw with Chief Lopez is rather than look into it and say, thank you for that information, it's uncomfortable, it's not something I'm happy to see, but I'm the chief of this department, we need to look into this with greater detail and find out what's at the bottom of this. And instead what we saw, I think, is a stonewall.
We're talking today about the facts and figures about racial stops, profiling stops in general, and accusations of racial profiling aimed at the Durham Police Department. Frank Baumgartner is a political science professor at UNC Chapel Hill. Ian Mance is a civil rights attorney for the Southern Coalition for Social Justice. And our conversation will continue on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, today talking about controversies surrounding the Durham Police Department. Last week, Chief Lopez was on. This week, we have Ian Mance. He's a civil rights attorney for the Southern Coalition for Social Justice. Frank Baumgartner is a professor of political science at UNC Chapel Hill, who has done some of the research. Frank, let's talk about some of the other possibilities here. You know, one of the problems in any kind of statistical analysis is that you're dealing with averages, but often problems are created by outliers, by one or two or five or a small percentage of individuals within the force. Did you take a look at that, whether or not these problems, perhaps the disparate stops and searches, are caused by only a few officers, and what would happen if you took them out?
Well, Frank, that's a great question. And actually, this is where I think the police department response could have been very, very different. Because with these statistics that are reported every month to the State Department of Justice, a police department would be able to identify each officer and look at their reports, because each officer is identified with an ID number. And so you could look at, for officer number 165, you could say, well, that officer stopped 120 people last month, and among the whites he stopped, he searched X percent, and among the blacks he stopped, he searched Y percent of those people. And you could as a management tool, the police department would be able to look at the officers on a regular basis and see if anybody's out of line. We did that ourselves, and we identified the 38 officers that had the most disparate percentages of whites and blacks who were searched. And when we eliminate them from the analysis, we still observe, rather than 165% disparity, we still see 108% disparity. That means even eliminating those 38 officers that are most out of line with their behaviors, the department still has more than twice the probability of searching a black rather than searching a white motorist.
Well, Ian, that's what happens when you eliminate them statistically. But if something actually happened within the police department, if they were eliminated from the department or disciplined in some way, might that have an effect on the rest of the... In other words, if this is systemic and it's a cultural problem, can you address the problem by looking at the extremes?
I think so. I think that's part of the solution because... For example, I brought an example, actually, of a police officer that Frank had identified in his analysis. This is a Durham police officer who joined the force in January of 2006. In the time since he's been on the force, he stopped 709 black motorists and just 60 whites. Half of his stops were for standard vehicle violations, and yet this officer searched 63% of all black motorists he stopped, which is more than 20 times the rate of the average police officer. Certainly, if he was to be taken off the force, I think that would, send a message to fellow officers. But I also think we need to challenge this department to think of ways and policies that they can implement that will kind of disincentivize this sort of behavior. So, for example, one of the things that the FADE Coalition, which has been the primary vehicle, the primary organization driving a lot of this conversation in Durham, one of the things that FADE has recommended is that the department engage in periodic reviews of officer stop data. So, for example, every 3 months, the chief should get a report I'm not sure what the threshold should be, but perhaps the top 25 or 50 officers generating the most racially disparate stops and searches. And in a department of 500 officers, those 25 would report and have to explain to the chief or proffer a race-neutral explanation for why they end up at the top of the list. If the officers know that is a potential consequence of generating highly racially disparate outcomes, it may cause them to think twice when it comes to these borderline stops that we're concerned about.
You mentioned FADE, and the point of this program, the chief was on and he challenged the numbers that you have been using that Frank, and a report that Frank Baumgartner, my other guest today, generated. So we thought we'd have you on to talk about that particular part of this. Mm-hmm. FADE is not in on this conversation yet, but the problem won't go away, and we expect to have them on. But this other question came up. The chief questioned whether or not the complaints represent a large portion of the population of Durham, whether many people are behind this, or whether we're representing just the views of very, very few people. FADE is one. Do you have any sense of who else is behind you? Who are you? Who is FADE? And what kind of support do you have?
Sure. Well, the FADE Coalition is a multiracial coalition of different faith leaders throughout the community, community organizers, civil rights activists, people who are involved in their local neighborhood associations, just individuals who live in the community of Durham and are concerned about the state of policing. So the FADE Coalition has been, in existence for about a year, kind of sounding the alarm on racially disparate police practices. What I would say to the chief's comment that we are a small group is that the FADE agenda, as it's kind of come to be known, which is the five primary policy reforms that FADE has advocated and put to the city council, has found widespread support throughout the community. We've received written endorsements from a wide variety of groups, to include the ACLU of North Carolina, the NAACP of Durham, the People's Alliance, the Committee on the Affairs of Black People, the George H. White Bar Association, which is the professional association for black lawyers in Durham, Action NC, the Durham Congregations in Action, Durham CAN, which is Communities, Associations, and Neighborhoods. I mean, a large number of groups have come out and written letters to City Council, to the Human Relations Commission, endorsing the FADE agenda in whole. And I expect that as this issue moves to City Council in the next couple weeks, that we will hear more from those groups.
I want to talk a little bit more about the numbers and why they may show up the way they do, why the disparities may occur. Chief Lopez indicated, and Frank, I'll address this one to you. Chief Lopez indicated that racial disparities can be explained because of heavier patrolling. Look, you go into high crime areas, which coincidentally and for a variety of reasons may include a higher concentration of people of color, and therefore those numbers are going to be skewed. Frank, can you control for that?
Well, actually, in our report, the answer is no, we can't, because they don't report the neighborhood in which the stop occurred. But I would say that this is potentially one of those systemic factors that would potentially explain some of these differences that goes beyond any allegation, which we're not making, of individual-level bias on the part of individual police officers. It could be very well that the police department sends more officers into certain places. But that still doesn't explain why, even in those places, a higher percentage of blacks would be searched after they're stopped as compared to whites.
I mean, do we know that's true, that in those areas there's a disproportionate number of African Americans or people of color searched within that
area? We only know citywide for the entire agency. But it's 80% of all the searches are of African Americans, only 20% of whites.
So again, that's first there's the stop, and then there's the decision to search, and that becomes another threshold that has yet to be explained.
You know, the population of Durham is about 41% black. About 60%, 59% of all the stops are of blacks, and then 80% of the searches are of African Americans. So these are very robust findings that, you could try to find ways to explain it away, or you could take it for what it is, which I would say is official statistics, well-meaning analysts trying to serve the public, and unfortunately, it comes across as a criticism of the police department. And it is a criticism. It's an important problem. I would like to see the police department engage in a constructive effort to try to solve this issue or explain it rather than deny it.
African Americans make up 41% of the population, but Ian, you've pointed out, and nationally the statistics will confirm, and I'm sure you could find it here locally, of the driving population of car ownership, the percentage of people of color who own cars is far, far less, which would actually suggest an even bigger disproportion.
Right. I mean, I think that the statistics we've highlighted, if anything, might have been too generous to the department, because the actual disparities are, like you said, probably greater, in part because of the car ownership rates and the driving rates, but also because, you know, at Southern Coalition, we've been able to document multiple instances of vehicle searches that just were not recorded at all. You know, almost the more egregious they are, the less likely the officer is to report it. So very often I will encounter individuals who tell me about, you know, a harrowing stop experience. They give me the time and date and reason for the stop, and I can pull it up in my database. And oftentimes I will not find it at all. Or if I do find it, I'll find that it was reported as a consent search when the individual I'm talking to is telling me that is very adamant that they never, in fact, gave consent to search.
Yeah, it's one of the recommendations that you have made, or your organization, that the consent searches become a matter of written consent and mandatory.
Right. Well, right now, Durham police have the discretion to use a written consent to search form. They just choose not to. But written consent to search forms, which has been one of the policy objectives of the FADE organization and community partners that have supported FADE, are really not a radical proposal. They're in use. They're mandated in four states, 17 different police agencies, state police agencies nationwide. Mandate them as a matter of police protocol. Large cities like Austin, Texas, and Dallas, Texas require them. You'll find support for written consent to search forms. If you ask the district attorney's office very often, they will say that it saves them the trouble of having to fight about the voluntariness of a search. There have been examples recently in North Carolina where first-degree murder convictions have been upheld because the murder weapon was found in a vehicle and the police thought to get written consent before they searched it. And that was the deciding factor. There's actually really compelling law enforcement reasons to support written consent. I think it's a, you know, it's a no cost solution, to this problem. Not to say that it's a, you know, a fix all solution, but I do think that the adoption of mandatory written consent to search forms would be a very significant change that not only would help drive down these disparities, which we have seen growing with each passing year, but would also help build trust in communities in Durham where there is not a lot of trust between people and the police.
Another area where there is a great deal of disparity that you've explored is in drug enforcement. And you talk about that and the impact that that's having.
Sure. Well, Durham has the highest racial incarceration disparity for drug crimes in North Carolina. I think Edgecombe County might be ahead of them, but it's a very small sample size. But for any of the sizable cities and counties in North Carolina, you will not find a greater racial disparity in terms of who is locked up in the county jail for drug crimes. And this particularly so with marijuana, where we have some of the more compelling data. My colleague Daryl Atkinson at Southern Coalition has actually geocoded marijuana arrests in Durham and found that the overwhelming majority of them occur in predominantly black neighborhoods. We know that marijuana-related offenses are among the top 10 most frequently charged crimes in Durham, that you know, a marijuana arrest can trigger hundreds of collateral consequences that can impact an individual's ability to get an education, to get a job.
Well, the chief was here and said, look, we don't target that. If we're doing other things, we're investigating, if we find marijuana, we'll make the arrest, but that's not what we're looking for. That's what he said here.
Well, I would respectfully have to disagree with the chief. He made that representation to the City Human Relations Commission back in the fall that marijuana arrests were really only made when officers stumble across them. However, at Southern Coalition, we did a public records request back in the fall, and we received thousands of pages in response documenting hundreds and hundreds of undercover marijuana stings in predominantly black neighborhoods in Durham, where the amount of drugs purchased were $10 or less. In fact, I can give you some numbers. Between 2011 and 2013, the department made over 330 marijuana arrests where the amount of marijuana in question was less than $20 worth.
Well, okay, you might make a small buy, but you could have a big dealer at the other end of that. So that could still be pretty good enforcement.
Well, possibly. I mean, I'm sure that is the argument that they would make. I don't know that, in fact, that they are flipping all of these folks. And in any case, I would question the wisdom of that strategy and the situation that they're putting people who are involved in very low-level drug possession offenses, trying to leverage them into testifying against other people. I just don't know that that is a wise use of city resources.
Marijuana is in pretty widespread use across this city and across the state. Where are most of these arrests made?
Well, most of these, I can only speak for Durham specifically, but the overwhelming majority of marijuana arrests in Durham occur in neighborhoods or census tracts where the population of African Americans between the age of 16 and 34 is over 60%.
Mm. And what's behind this? You've talked about some federal grants that may be, in some ways, providing the incentive.
Sure. Well, there's a program called the Edward J. Byrne JAG program. This is an old federal program. It's been around for decades, and it provides supplementary funding to police departments across the country for a variety of reasons, not just drug prosecutions. But in Durham, in 2009, the city received a grant somewhere in the neighborhood of $750,000 specifically to do drug enforcement. And what we saw between 2009 and 11, which was the years that the grant was operable, was a doubling in the number of vehicle searches and searches of people citywide. And so we don't think that that is a coincidence. We believe that the federal grant money allowed the officers to be much more aggressive in making these arrests. And one of the criticisms that has been labeled with respect to the JAG program is that it incentivizes low-level arrests because among the performance indicators that are used to evaluate whether a department will be funded in the future is numbers of arrests. And the federal government does not currently differentiate in terms of arrests of low-level people in possession of minor amounts of marijuana, and someone who is trafficking drugs. And there are actually talks now in Washington and the Justice Department about changing those performance measures.
So the Department of Justice in Washington has recognized that this is a problem, that they have perhaps unintentionally created this incentive. They're looking at it.
Well, there has not been an official announcement, but there was recently an article on Salon.com about the city of Durham and Byrne JAG program here. And in it, they quoted Vinita Gupta, who is a high-level attorney at the National ACLU who said in the article that she has been in discussions with DOJ about changing that very metric.
Conviction bonuses, so-called, are also part of this conversation. The chief said that was just poor wording. We don't pay for convictions. Informants who were paid for their services but not based on the conviction.
Well, so there's the backstory to the conviction bonuses is we did a records request, same one that got us all these records on marijuana arrests, tens of thousands of pages of documents, and among them were nine pages that reflected a request to withdraw money from the city informants fund to render payments to informants in drug cases. And on the memos, on those forms, were the phrases bonus for conviction, and it identified the suspect. And it had a date on it. And when we cross-referenced the date, obviously we were alarmed seeing this phrase bonus for conviction. So the first thing we did was we cross-referenced this with publicly available court data. We found out that this money was paid after the date of conviction, which begged the question of whether or not defense attorneys had been made aware that informants were being paid. And so I reached out to the various defense attorneys who represented these individuals, and to a person, they all said that they were unaware of any payments flowing to informants. We took the information to the Durham District Attorney's Office, presented to Roger Eccles, who looks like he's going to be our next DA. And, they put out a statement disavowing any knowledge of this practice and money flowing to informants after the fact. What I would say to Chief Lopez, I know he takes real issue with this, the characterization of these as conviction bonuses. And I suppose it is possible that it was just inartfully worded, although I take it to mean what it says. Even if the money paid to these informants post-conviction was not contingent upon conviction, it's still problematic from the perspective of what we call Brady discovery. You have an obligation as a district attorney to turn over any information that could potentially used impeaching a witness. And so defense counsel always has a right to know when informants are being paid. And the assistant chief of police, John Peter, acknowledged to the Independent Weekly just last month that undisclosed amounts of money are flowing to informants in drug cases.
And by paying after the fact, after the trial, whatever you call them, it meant that I didn't have to disclose that, which the law does require. And
right.
So this becomes
and it
a
also,
problem.
Of course, raises the question of whether or not these are off the record, arrangements being made between informants and officers that just aren't being memorialized in writing.
Ian Mann, civil rights attorney for the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, Frank Baumgartner, political science professor at UNC. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you, Frank.
Coming up, hip-hop from artist King Mez on The State of Things. Stay tuned.